All told, there were about a dozen families living on the easterly slopes of Signal Hill, and particularly in that saddle area between Signal Hill proper and Reservoir Hill. Some of the dwellings in that area were small wooden structures housing Japanese vegetable farmers. They, that is, these Japanese were what was known in those days as truck farmers. They grew vegetables, melons, berries, and so forth in an area just north of Grant Street and along what is now Redondo Avenue. The areas under cultivation by the Japanese truck farmers covered that portion of the area now occupied by the National Guard Center, and the farms extended about as far north along Redondo as the Los Angeles Long Beach General Hospital. This was very fertile ground with good drainage, and the Japanese made good use of it. They were out there every day, rain or shine, every holiday, every weekend, from dawn until dusk, stooping, bending, cultivating, hoeing, and picking their produce, which either they or other family members sold in the markets in Long Beach. Virtually every market in those days, every food store, had a vegetable produce center which was run by Japanese. And some of my very earliest experiences in speaking the Japanese language came about when I used to sell my father's avocados to these Japanese people who would be selling produce in the stores. Sometimes during the summer months, on a moonless night, friends of mine, other boys in the neighborhood, and I would creep cautiously down the north slope of Reservoir Hill and penetrate into the watermelon and cantaloupe areas that the Japanese were cultivating. And there, with much furtive whispering and admonitions to be quiet, we would make off with watermelons and cantaloupes, scurrying back up the slope of the hill to break them open, hot and musky in the dark, and wolf them down, thinking it was some of the greatest food we ever ate, all the time looking apprehensively over our shoulders for a menacing figure which might suddenly appear brandishing a shotgun. We had all sorts of theories that the Japanese would be patrolling their vegetable gardens with shotguns loaded with buckshot, ready to blow the pants off any boy foolish or daring enough to make off with their watermelons. However, we never saw a Japanese with a gun. We never saw a Japanese at night, and most of our apprehension was entirely mental. Some of the more interesting incidents concerning the Japanese would occur from time to time when one of the unfortunate Japanese families would suffer their home being burned down. The Japanese, as is well known, are very cleanly people, and no Japanese would think of occupying a home in which there wasn't a hot tub, a hot bath, always ready for family members to use. And these tubs were heated by wood kindling, which was burned underneath the metal tubs, providing the heat to heat the water. And sometimes, through misadventure, the fires would spread to the wooden dwellings and burn them to the ground. Because, of course, in those days, we had no fire department on Signal Hill. Anything that caught fire was either put out by the owners themselves, by whatever means they could muster, or the building, whatever it was, burnt to the ground. Some months after oil was discovered on Signal Hill, the Japanese left their truck farms. The farms were then turned over to oil supply yards and oil well drilling sites, mostly occupied by a Shell Oil Company, who had the Alamese Land Company lease on the northeastern slope of Signal Hill. I don't know where the Japanese went. Presumably they found other places where they could grow their produce. Frankly, nobody gave much thought to the Japanese after oil was discovered. They simply disappeared. In those days before oil was discovered, Signal Hill and Reservoir Hill were veritable paradises for any boy who liked to hunt, fish, or just plain explore. There were gullies and ravines, particularly along the north slope of Reservoir Hill and Signal Hill, where the water would run off, creating wonderful hiding places for rabbits, snakes, and an occasional coyote. Also, the Signal Hill area was rich in doves and quail. And many was the time that I went with my father when he carried his shotgun, and I tagged along to go hunting on the slopes of Reservoir Hill. We shot doves on these trips that were enough to feed our small family. I used to trap rabbits on the hill, but I discontinued that after a while because, well, quite honestly, I couldn't stand the suffering engendered by the cruel steel traps that the rabbits would get their legs caught in. For a while, I had my bedroom walls covered with rabbit skins that I'd trapped, but as I just said, I ceased that after a while. I also used to like to hunt snakes on Signal Hill. There were many, many gopher snakes there. Harmless, of course. They belonged to the constrictor family. Their bite was a little bit painful, but certainly not poisonous. I remember the largest snake that I caught on the slopes of Reservoir Hill was considerably longer than I was tall. It measured 6 feet 2 inches. And I had the devil's own time wrestling with that snake because I was about 10 years of age, and I was almost no match for the snake. He wrapped himself around my neck and my chest and squeezed and writhed and did everything possible to discourage me, but I was able to capture the snake, and in about 3 weeks, his skin adorned my bedroom wall. The large square reservoir at the top of Reservoir Hill, where at the present time the city of Long Beach's water is contained in large steel tanks, this reservoir was completely open to the elements. And we didn't think much about sanitary precautions in those days, and possibly the water was indeed adequately filtered. But every so often there would be a rumor sweeping through the little community that a dead body had been found floating in the water, and none of us should drink the water for several weeks. Well, our parents, of course, poo-pooed all this, but we boys used to get together and furtively whisper about the body, which was indeed dragged out, but nobody was supposed to know about it, and we should just go on and pretend that this never happened. Actually, looking back on it, in retrospect, I don't think any body was ever found floating in the reservoir, but it certainly made titillating gossip for us and was a juicy subject every time it came up. In the summertime, we used to build or take out the wooden sleds that we had made the previous summer. And although none of us, except maybe some newcomers who had come in from the east, none of us had ever seen snow. Up to that time, I was 10 or 11 years of age, we had never seen snow except at a distance 100 miles away in the mountains. But somehow we fashioned sleds, which were quite similar to snow sleds. And during the later months of the summer, August and September, the long grass on the north slope of Signal Hill and Reservoir Hill would turn brown and slick, and we would slide down the hill, bumping and soaring into the air, slamming down on the hard earth again, going over this grass, which was very, very slippery. You must envisage the whole north slope of Reservoir Hill in particular covered with grass some 2 feet in height, shining golden in the sun, that when pressed down to the earth would form a very slick pathway for our sleds. And all day long we would slide down the hill whooping and yelling to end up on the bottom and then trudge back up the hill again. It was great sport and the closest we in Southern California could come to snow sledding. Our drinking water, of course, was from artesian wells located in the area where the Douglas Aircraft Plant and the present Long Beach Municipal Airport is established. These wells were literally artesian wells, that is, they were flowing wells. And the water was yellowish in color and had a pronounced sulfur smell, which used to baffle any visitors which we would have from out of state, because they would run a bathtub full of our local water, which we accepted as being perfectly good and the only type of water that was available. They'd run a bathtub full of this yellowish, sulfur-smelling water and promptly drain it, thinking that the plumbing in our house was rusty. And then we would have to explain to these visitors that that was the kind of water which we had there. And they would say it smelled awful and it looked awful. But, of course, we were used to it. And for years I thought that was the only kind of water there was, a sort of a brownish, yellowish water smelling of sulfur. In fact, pure water, which I would have occasion to drink when I was 15 or 16 years of age, and we went someplace like Los Angeles or San Diego, the pure water, the white water, was a tasteless substance which I disliked. I have thought many times in the passing years that there was nothing wrong with that Long Beach water, that Signal Hill water. It was probably very good for us. In the early 1920s, Signal Hill was a very pastoral place. It was quiet. Occasionally a cow would moo or a rooster crow. Goats would go baa. There were ground squirrels all over the hill. Gopher snakes abounded. An occasional coyote could be seen skulking around in some ravine or dry gully. It was a quiet place. And then came the advent of oil. And this probably, in retrospect, I would say was the most exciting, thrilling, dramatic, and romantic thing that ever happened to me. In fact, it colored and shaped my entire life. Sometime in the early part of 1921, when I was 10 years of age and going to Temple Avenue School, I walked up Signal Hill after school to see what the activity was up on Temple Avenue near the crest of the hill. And when I arrived at the scene, I could see mules grading the ground and construction workers busily hauling in piles of lumber. And overcome with curiosity, I asked a man who appeared to be the foreman, what's going on here anyway? And he turned to me and he said, Sonny, we're going to drill an oil well here. So that evening, as we were having dinner at home, down the slope a little ways from where the land was being graded, I said to my father and mother, oh, say, they're going to drill a well, an oil well, up on the hill. I was up there this afternoon after school and saw them grade the ground. Well, of course, this was a very exciting bit of information to give to my parents, although not entirely unexpected, because for the past 2 or 3 months, we had had a number of so-called lease hounds soliciting my father and other neighbors there for leases on their property in anticipation that Shell would indeed drill a well there. So the news that Shell was going to drill a well was not unexpected, but it wasn't expected to be so soon as this. Well, in due course, Shell erected the derrick for its Alamitas No. 1 well and commenced drilling. At least once a week, I trudged up from Temple Avenue School to the drill site and watched the men drill. I found it an extremely fascinating operation. There was the roar of the boilers, the heat from the steam, the blasts of the pop-off valves of the boilers when the steam pressure became too great, and of course there was the thrilling clanking and roar of the twin-engined rotary drilling equipment spinning the rotary table. Much clanking of chains, noise so intense that you couldn't make yourself heard on the drilling floor. Men would have to lean within an inch of another man's ear and shout as loudly as they could in order to be heard. Well, in the spring of 1921, either April or May of 1921, I walked up the hill, as was my custom, as I have recounted, to see what was going on. And when I arrived at the drill site, the drilling bit had just been removed from the hole, and there was oil shows, what we called colors, iridescent rainbow glimmers of oil colors shining on the derrick floor where the wet and dripping drill pipe had let the drilling fluid cascade on the wooden planks of the derrick floor, and along with it the oil colors. The drilling crew, of course, was greatly excited, and so was I. And when I again went down the hill that day to go home, I said to my parents, "They've struck oil on the hill." And of course, that was exciting news indeed. Shell Oil Company ran a protective string of casing in the hole, cemented it in place, took out the rotary drilling equipment, and switched over to cable tool drilling, the pound and pound and bale method. At 3,114 feet, after passing through almost continuous oil sands for the last 300 feet, Shell decided to stop and test the well for production. On June 23, 1921, while the crew was baling the well down for the production test, it suddenly blew in, shooting a great column of gassy oil 150 feet into the air. Of course, I again was present on that historic occasion. Valves were quickly closed and the oil directed into tanks, and when news of this production test and blowout became known, a large crowd of excited and jubilant spectators quickly gathered at the Temple Avenue drill site to marvel at this great discovery. However, the well sanded up and ceased production, and a clean-out job was immediately instituted. And 2 days later, in the early morning hours of July 25, 1921, I, my parents, and my parents' friends, neighbors, and hundreds of other people gathered at the drill site and watched with great excitement as the well was again baled down. After several hours of expectancy and anticipation, oil began to gush in what we termed by heads from the top of the control valve at the head of the casing with every return of the baler. Then, as the baler was being brought out, with a rumbling roar, the baler was blown entirely from the hole, and an immense column of gas and oil shot high over the top of the derrick. This time, the well continued flowing into the production tanks. And in the first 24 hours of production, the Discovery well flowed 590 barrels of 22-degree gravity oil and within a few days the rate had increased to 1,200 barrels per day. The vast Signal Hill oil field had been discovered by the Alamitas No. 1, and I was present, as I have said, one of the greatest thrills of my entire life. Most of us were splattered with oil droplets, but we didn't care. Men threw their hats in the air, yelling with excitement and joy. Women laughed, children ran around, dogs barked frantically, and then when the well was shut in and flowing into the tanks, we went down the hill, our faces blackened with fresh crude oil, and realized that we had been witnesses to a truly historic event. During the first 2 years of drilling for oil on Signal Hill, that is, during the years 1921 and 1922, I witnessed many oil fires and gassers, wells blowing out, serious accidents. Before I was 12 years of age, I had seen men fall off derricks to be killed on the ground below. I had seen men horribly burned and disfigured, and I had seen enormous gassers roaring out of control. The absolutely heedless, frantic, breakneck rush to reach the oil sands, together with the almost total ignorance of what lay below, deep in the earth, and the magnitude of the gas pressures contained there, made it a virtual certainty that gassers and out-of-control wells would break loose on the hill. And this was particularly true on top of the structure, where greater pressures were encountered than on the flanks. In a sense, the early drillers were blind. That is, they were directing a rapidly revolving drill bit deep into the unknown with men and machinery operating on the surface. And what that bit might penetrate was literally anyone's guess. And no one much cared. The name of the game was truly get there first. Get there before your competitors could get there. And haste, lack of knowledge, inadequate equipment, lack of protective devices, and oftentimes plain carelessness exacted their toll in the form of violent gas and oil blowouts. Catastrophes were bound to occur, and the first wild well broke loose with dramatic suddenness 2 months after the discovery of oil on Signal Hill. At around midnight of September 1, 1921, I was reading a book in an alcove just off of our living room in our little house on Signal Hill. On the opposite side of the living room, in a matching alcove, My father sat reading quietly to my mother from the current issue of the Saturday Evening Post. The hill was quiet. It was a moonless quiet, broken only by the sound of grinding rotary tables and the occasional sharp metallic clang of drill pipe from drilling wells. At the very top of the hill, the drilling crew on the early morning graveyard tower, or third shift, of the Shell Oil Company NASA No. 1 had just reported for work, and they were routinely engaged in pounding away with their great weight of cable tools at the cement plug at the bottom of the hole, which had been put in place there following landing of casing and cementing off 2 weeks previously. Well, the large wooden walking beam of the NASA well rocked up and down, driven by the massive steel crank on the huge wooden band wheel. The single-cylinder mail pouch steam engine chugged and wheezed as it exerted power to activate the band wheel to raise and lower the drilling tools, and the heavy drilling bit at the end of its thick cable rose and fell as it intermittently smashed against the retainer plug. Then, as we sat quietly reading, a few blocks away, it happened. Suddenly, with no warning, the drill bit, some 2,500 feet deep in the earth, broke through the plug and into an immense accumulation of high-pressure gas straining for release. At once, mud, water, rocks, cable, and drill bit were hurled from the hole. With a thunderous roar, the escaping gas blasted from the open casing on the derrick's floor, and sparks flew, and metal clanged as rocks struck it. The panic-stricken drilling crew ran for their lives away from the screaming monster they had unwittingly unleashed. And for a few seconds, the raging gasser failed to ignite. Then, with a thudding boom that almost knocked us from our chairs in our living room and that startled the sleeping residents of the hill, the rushing gas exploded in the wooden derrick. We immediately ran to the windows and looked upward towards the crest of the hill, and there we could see an enormous, roaring, fiery column of burning oil and gas shooting high into the sky. Everything was illuminated. I think we could have read our books outdoors there at midnight from the light from that raging gasser. We rushed out of the house and began to jog up the hill. And as we did, the heavy crisscross beams of the derrick disintegrated and toppled with a crash that shook the ground under our feet. And the roaring column of fire, and now a gigantic blowtorch of incredible force and heat, shot up into the night sky. This pillar of fire illuminated the hill with an unearthly brilliance. It was frightening, awesome, and spectacular. The flaming NASA number one hurled its defiance at the residents of Signal Hill, the workmen who attempted to control it, for days. At first, the blazing torch appeared invincible, too mighty for mere man to conquer, and it was spoken of in our house in those days following the first ignition of the gas that the well would burn forever. It didn't seem like puny man could possibly tame that raging monster. But with urgent desperation, crews of workmen working around the clock rigged up boilers, pumps, pipes, and hoses and prepared to do battle. Steam was blasted at the well. Tons of mud and water were shot at it. Finally, the combined onslaught at length extinguished the fire, and the well was quickly capped before it could ignite again. But the Shell NASA 1 was only a foreboding of things to come. Other wild gassers followed. The most spectacular blowouts were those on the top of the hill. Shell Oil Company's Wilbur No. 1 was the next well to catch fire, and I watched it. And the Martin No. 1 caught fire. The Martin No. 1 was putting out so much gas and so much sand, and the fire was so hot that it completely dried the mud and water being shot out with the gas. And I can recall walking down to school, the school on Temple Avenue, from my house, and as I walked out of our front gate, the ground beneath my feet was gritty from the sand falling out of the sky from the Martin No. 1 gasser as it burned fiercely. And I carried my lunch bag with me, my brown bag in which my mother had placed my lunch to go to school. And as I walked the approximately 2 miles to school along the southeast flank of the hill, the sand from the burning gasser came showering down out of the sky, and I could hear it rattling against the paper bag in which I carried my lunch. After school, 2 or 3 days later, I walked up on the hill, up near the Martin No. 1, and I watched workmen, shielded by corrugated iron, bolted onto frames of timbers, inch their way up to the flaming gasser with 100 pounds of dynamite, pushed out ahead of them, and placed the 100 pounds of dynamite as close as they dared to the mouth of the well, then scurried for cover. The dynamite was exploded by electrical charge, and as I crouched behind a retaining wall, the gasser was snuffed out just as if one had blown out a candle. Other great gassers followed. There was the General Petroleum Black and Drake No. 1, which roared away for days and days. It never caught fire, but it covered the ground all around it for blocks with mud, sand, and oil. It was a terrible, terrible mess. This is a note from the narrator. This will be the end of side B of tape 1. On side A,